Good morning. This holiday season, the thoughts of many turn to community. That can bring joy, but also challenges, like the holiday blues. Mental health is a community concern at every time of the year. We'll explore that more with Robert Kawasana, the Maui County Director of Mental Health America of Hawaii. And Japan's Prime Minister comes to Pearl Harbor next week. We'll have some perspective from Pacific Forum CSIS Executive Director Brad Glosserman about Shinzo Abe, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and the future of U.S.-Japan relations. I'm Bill Dorman, in for Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. The Hawaii Symphony and the Oahu Choral Society will perform Beethoven's great last symphony, the Ninth, and its Ode to Joy. And holidays are high time for moviegoers. This year's Maui Film Festival's first light screenings remind us of the best offerings of the year gone by.
Thursday, December 22nd, Conversation After News. Good morning, 8:06 on the Conversation here, and Chris Vanderkirk joining us. Another bit of music, bit of film, bit of holiday focus.
Yeah, one of the things I like, Bill, about this time of the year is sort of reflecting on what kind of year has it been, both good and bad. But we'll sort of look at a year-end concert and the movies that we saw during the past year.
Very good. You know, it's also holiday season can also be a stressful time for a lot of folks. It can be difficult. The holiday stress, depression can strike. That is one reason why this time of year there's sometimes a focus on mental health and not just the holiday blues, but mental illness itself, what it is, also what it's not. Joining us this morning to help us understand some of those issues, Robert Kawasana. He's the Maui County Director of Mental Health America of Hawaii. He's also been a substance abuse counselor for some 30 years and is active in a wide variety of professional activities as well. Joins us on the line from Maui this morning. Robert, thank you. And just briefly to start on this point about the holiday blues, how common is that?
Okay, Bill. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity being on the call this morning. There's a difference, really, Bill, between the holiday blues and mental illness. We all get depressed, and we all struggle at different times in our lives. But mental illness is a thing unto itself, Bill.
And what are some of common misperceptions, to start with, in terms of mental illness?
Well, one of the most common is that it's a defect of a person's ability to cope. You know, there's moral judgment surrounding mental illness. And that's changing. Cancer used to have that same type of stigma. And, you know, nowadays when somebody is diagnosed with cancer or another physical disability, people bring over a potluck dinner to make their life easier. However, still with mental illness, when you tell someone that your son or daughter is suffering from mental illness, there's not a lot of potluck dinners that come to your door. People kind of walk in the opposite direction, Bill.
But that idea also that as with cancer, as with other chronic conditions sometimes, this is a treatable disease.
It is. It is. I do a support group in the jail here in Maui, MCCC, and the saddest thing that I'm confronted with is the people in the Maui County Jail are in there principally for treatable diseases. I'm one side of my support group, there's people struggling with a variety of mental illnesses, mental disabilities, and on the other side of the support group, there's people with substance abuse. And, Bill, both of those are treatable diseases, and it saddens me to see young men locked up for these things.
Well, and given your experience as a substance abuse counselor, talk a little bit more, if you will, about that connection between substance abuse and mental health.
Well, it's what we call a co-occurring disorder, Bill, when somebody has both a mental illness and is using substances. And what happens is people with a mental illness usually self-medicate, oftentimes self-medicate in order to quiet the voices, perhaps, in their mind. And then what happens is the substance abuse itself becomes a major disabling factor for people. It's real sad. It's real sad that people suffer with the with a mental illness or substance abuse, and then also have stigma attached to them that makes it difficult for them to get services. You know, an interesting fact, Bill, often the majority of people suffer for 10 years before they seek help. And that's because of the stigma associated with mental illness and substance abuse.
Now, you've been working in this area for many years, and you have been the program director for the Aloha House Substance Abuse Treatment Facility, the clinical director of the Drug Court and Custody Program at the Maui County Jail. Are you seeing any progress on this score, or what progress are you seeing, and what do you see as the immediate challenges that we have here in Hawaii, particularly in terms of making progress?
Thanks for that question, Bill. Here in Hawaii, we were doing pretty well up until 2008, when we had an economic downturn in the islands, and services began to be cut back in 2008. But the past few years, things are getting better. There's more resources. A major law just was passed through the House and the Senate in Washington, and Obama signed 21st Century Cures. That's going to get some more money flowing. Hawaii itself just got a major grant from SAMHSA to educate primary care physicians. That money's coming into Hawaii. So I have hope, but the biggest challenge is chronically mentally ill folks. Of course, you probably know that we've shut down what we call mental health asylums. That happened in the Reagan era. People were discharged to the street, and there should have been wraparound services for these people, community-based services for people suffering, and those by and large weren't well funded. So then you have homeless people wandering the streets, and when you see somebody gesturing and talking out loud as they're walking down the street, that's someone possibly with schizophrenia who's having delusions. And so that's the biggest challenge for us, to wrap services around people and take care of them.
And are you seeing, in terms of progress, again, from that, because there are, as you say, so many threads there. There can be a thread of substance abuse. There can be a thread also of economic impoverishment, which then exacerbates underlying conditions, not just in terms of services, but also societally. Is the way of thinking of this, is that, have you seen that also shift since the time of the 80s, and do you feel we're going in a better direction right now with that?
I think we are going in a better direction, Bill. And what is strongly coming to the fore is peer support services. These are folks suffering from mental illness helping other folks suffer from mental illness. And there's what's called the recovery movement of consumers. And I use that term, and what it means is a person who consumes social services in the community, mental health services. Consumers are finding their voice and demanding the services and the consideration that anyone with a disability is entitled to, with our given laws, Bill.
Robert, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts this morning, for joining us. Robert Colasano, the Maui County Director of Mental Health America of Hawaii. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It is 8:16. Coming up, the Hawaii Symphony and the Oahu Choral Society's annual celebration of joy and freedom. But first, here's your quiz.
Coming up in the program, we'll be taking a look at the upcoming visit to Hawaii by Shinzo Abe, who is, of course, the Prime Minister of Japan. The visit garnered much fanfare after its announcement due to the inclusion of a stop at Pearl Harbor on the Prime Minister's itinerary. It was widely reported a few weeks ago that this would be the first visit to Pearl Harbor by a Japanese prime minister since the Second World War battle in 1941. But on further research, this proved false. That distinction actually belongs to Shigeru Yoshida, who made a brief stop in Hawaii on the way home from an international trip in 1951. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the purpose of Prime Minister Yoshida's trip that brought him through Hawaii and Pearl Harbor in 1951? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right will get a prize.
Aloha, I'm George Green from the Healthcare Association of Hawaii. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
It's one of the most exalted passages in music and one of the perfect pairings of poetry and music, the final choral movement of Beethoven's last symphony, the Ninth. Friedrich Schiller's An die Freude, the Ode to Joy, is a celebration of human equality where beggars are a prince's brother, as well as an appeal for the freedom of alle Menschen, all the peoples of the world. The Hawaii Symphony's upcoming performance of the Ninth, in concert with the Oahu Choral Society, is one of the most powerful musical celebrations of the year, and Kip Wilborn, one of its featured vocalists, is with us this morning. Good morning, Kip.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Just in that little segment we heard just before the start of the interview, I got that feeling of the sense of anticipation you get that in the last movement where it's coming, right?
Yeah, it's coming. And as I said to you earlier, I have the best seat in the house.
Yeah.
I get to sit there right in front of the orchestra and listen.
What's going through your mind when you hear that, like that particular passage, aside from I've got my slot coming up in a few more bars?
Yeah. Well, I hope I remember I have my slot.
Exactly.
I get kind of caught up in the music.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's such a, just at the beginning, I was just thinking at that moment when you played it, I said, oh my gosh, it sounds like the orchestra tuning.
Yeah.
And then there's the pa-da-ba-ba-ba. Yeah, it's really great.
One of the greatest things about the way that last choral movement is constructed is the way anticipation is built by the composer, right?
Right.
As that sort of floating chord that we just heard, it's kind of all the notes that we're going to hear later in the melody all sort of mush together, and then they separate, and then they all come back. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's really, you know, Beethoven. He had this ability to craft everything in such a perfect way, and I remember hearing a quote. This is not an exact quote, but Bernstein said something to this effect that no matter what was happening in his life when he played Beethoven, because of its beautiful construction and everything was so right, it made him feel like all was right in the world.
You know, one of the characteristics of his music is that sort of inevitability, that the way things are put together is the only way it could have been put together.
Right. That's exactly the way it feels.
Meanwhile, we have the only moment in a Beethoven symphony when words are joined to the music. Mm-hmm. What are those words telling us?
Well, it's saying that anyone who's, you know, willing to take the chance to be a friend to a friend, to love a beautiful woman, to have these different things, then it brings joy. And it equates the joy with the Creator and pulls it all together, that every man's experience is joy. And it encourages, in my part, in the Turkish March, it encourages all of the brothers, or all the people, to run the path of your life like a hero going to victory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Drunk with fire.
Yes, exactly. Just overwhelmed with the joy of existence.
You know, if you didn't know a word of German, and most of the people hearing it don't, you could probably get a pretty good idea of what was being said, wouldn't you?
Well, I guess I'm influenced by knowing the words, but it sounds like it.
It sure does.
I can't unknow the words, but boy, it sounds like the right thing for the words.
We were talking a little bit earlier this morning about how poetry and music often don't fuse, rarely fuse as well as they do here. I've sort of often wondered why that is. Maybe because poems are tend to be self-contained, and so does a good piece of music. You have to give a little to make them fit together, but somehow that works in this case, yeah?
Yeah, it's a beautiful marriage of the two, and I think that maybe in the crafting of a poem or the crafting of a instrumental piece, mm-hmm. The composer or the writer, they have their list of priorities, and of course they're different.
Yeah.
And so then putting them together, you have a contentious relationship normally, but this seems to be the perfect marriage.
What's your entrance? What are you singing at your entrance?
Well, it's kind of what I iterated a moment ago, was that we come in and we say, I'll make sure I get this. I'll read it here. Who has succeeded in the great attempt to be a friend's friend, whoever has won a lovely woman, and his to the jubilation, indeed, who calls at least one soul theirs upon the world, and whoever never managed shall steal himself weeping away from this union. I know it's very poetic, but it's basically saying all of these things that we've done in life, this existence, this joy, it all fuses together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one is alone.
Exactly. Exactly. We are all, Ala mentioned, we are the whole of humanity.
Mention not meaning men in this case, but meaning people.
Yeah, humankind.
Yeah. It's certainly, you know, for the end of this year, or for the end of any year, when we tend to reflect not just on the good things that have happened, but on the troubling things that happen. In a way, it has that effect you described in Bernstein's reaction, that putting everything, you know, everything is right. Everything is now in its place, at least for those moments.
Ah, it is. You know, I was looking at the words in the last section. It says, you millions, I embrace you. The kiss is for all the world. Brothers above the starry canopy, there must dwell a loving father. Do you fall in worship, you millions? World, do you know your creator? Seek him in the universe. Above the stars, he must dwell.
And, you know, That works wonderfully as words alone, but when you put that in terms of how it's constructed, and by the end, when all the themes are, because themes get introduced in the last movement, move away from them, and then they're reiterated, and then they're all sort of combined toward the end. It's just unbelievable how everything's going on at once, right?
Yes, combined in that, as you said earlier, in that only possible way for them to be perfect.
And it's so easy, or it's so difficult in music to make a lot of different elements combine in ways that come out unified. Yeah, it could easily become a mess having that many things going on at the same time.
Right. I think that I suppose that was part of Beethoven's passion, because we know of his composing style. He would write something, exit out. Write something, exit out.
Yeah.
And there was a million different tries until he got it exactly the way he wanted. Unlike someone like Mozart, who was very
fluid in his
composition, right?
And yet sometimes, you know, that effort can take you to a higher place. You almost want to feel that effort in terms of what the composer did.
Yeah, and I think that's captured in this piece.
It's got to be incredibly exciting for you, Kip, to be performing it.
I love it. I love this piece. I've been fortunate enough to do it with a symphony here, but also many times other places, and it's one of my joys.
Well, I think a lot of people are looking forward to it. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Pleasure to talk to you. Kip Wilborn is a tenor and one of the featured vocalists in the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra and the Oahu Choral Society's upcoming performance of Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, The Ode to Joy, Thursday and Friday next week at the Blaisdell Concert Hall in Honolulu.
Think of how often you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for music, culture, and companionship. The station's been here for you every day all year long. Before 2016 comes to a close, think about a tax-deductible gift to support the programming you enjoy. We gratefully acknowledge Stephanie Jongert of Kailua Kona, Lori and David Field of Waimanalo, and Sydney Landon of Honolulu for their generous support. Now it's your turn. You can call 955-8821 during business hours, or just go over to hawaiipublicradio.org and click donate. The use of solitary confinement is decreasing across the nation, but here in Hawaii, solitary confinement is used differently than it is in most other states. Chad Blair joins us now from Civil Beat with more on that story. And Chad, what is different about Hawaii's use of solitary confinement?
Good morning, Bill. Well, for one thing, we don't actually have a maximum security prison like just about every other state. But that doesn't mean that we don't have prisoners that are challenging when it comes to security. So at the Halawa Correctional Facility, there are actually about 120 prisoners that are deemed unfit for medium security. So there's actually a special needs facility that's on the complex to accommodate these prisoners. And by the way, similar to a lot of other places, but frightening if you think about it, that means that you can be isolated in a prison cell for up to 23 hours a day. At least one critic compared that to treating prisoners like an animal locked up in a dungeon.
Boy, you know, and Chad, we were talking earlier this morning, one of our guests, about mental health issues. And
Sure. There
is a link between that isolated confinement, not surprisingly, and mental illness. Surely this is a concern as well.
I mean, you can kind of understand why a violent prisoner would need to be isolated so they don't hurt other prisoners. You can understand maybe someone who's deemed an escape risk. But the data show that many of these maximum security inmates really are suffering from acute mental illness. And the studies bear out that prolonged isolation is shown to aggravate and even cause psychiatric problems. And this is something that is not to the benefit of either the inmates or the prison or society at large.
And this is something now in terms of on the radar for the upcoming legislative session in terms of lawmakers planning to take a look at this?
Yeah, Willis Sparrow, who's, as you know, the state senator, been very active in public safety. He wants to actually review how we're doing solitary confinement to see whether it's working. By the way, I should make clear, only currently, anyway, there's only 16 male prisoners that are actually classified as max security, and our 12 of those are actually in isolation cells. The four others are mixed into the general prison population. But yeah, Senator Sparrow is going to push for that bill to try and find out, because as you noted at the top, it's decreasing nationwide, solitary confinement bill. Even at that supermax prison in Colorado, the one where the Unabomber is being housed, even there they are easing conditions. That prison used to be called the toughest prison in America. By the way, I should note that it's part of a legal settlement to bring those conditions into better alignment with treatment.
And something that, again, in terms of the state level, taking a comparison to those national norms and the trends, something that's going to be getting attention in the upcoming session.
I think so. And we should say that an agency spokesperson did say, you know, we're looking at some of the things that appear to work, like rewarding good behavior to reduce isolation, giving them anger management programs, physical and mental wellness. They say they will look at these things. As you well know, prison overcrowding is a very serious problem, not just in the country, but particularly here. We send so many of our prisoners to Arizona. So this would seem to help relieve that overcrowding.
A lot to be done in the world of incarceration. Chad, thank you. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, joins us here on The Conversation on a regular basis. You've probably heard that Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is coming to Hawaii next week. He'll spend time at Pearl Harbor on Tuesday with President Obama, but that's just part of the symbolism and part of the substance of this visit. Brad Glosserman is the executive director of the Pacific Forum CSIS here in Honolulu, and he shared some thoughts on the trip with Bethann Koslovich.
The Abe visit seems to be a bookend to Obama's visit to Hiroshima earlier this year. Is there really more to it than that, though?
Yes. And first of all, I think that while both visits are really important, it is vitally important that they not be seen as strictly reciprocal. I think that what you're looking at is two leaders making important and crucial gestures in regard to the way that they and their countries look at and think about history, and to somehow or other frame it in ways that, well, if I do this, then you can do that, kind of cheapens, if you will, the power and the significance of those particular gestures. So I think one of the things that both of the governments, I've been told and I've read and I would anticipate, is that they have been working to de-link them, you know, officially, so that there is no quid pro quo and they're seen both as standalone gestures to each respective country. And I think that that's a really vital kind of understanding. But it's also more than that insofar, particularly for Prime Minister Abe, that this is part of a long-standing effort that dovetails with an agenda of his, which is to move Japan beyond the post-war, as they say. And that is that Japan has very much its behavior, its image, its reputation, I think, in the world, particularly in Asia, since 1945 has been seen, it colored by its behavior in the Imperial Japan of the Pacific War and the area that time that preceded it. And so Abe has tried to move on to say that in the 7 years that have passed since the end of that war, Japan is a different country. And there's a certain subtext to that as well that says Japan is being judged by a certain standard that perhaps isn't fair, you know, the victor's justice argument.
We keep seeing him as being this conservative nationalist, which fits into just what you said, and yet is also seemingly to embrace a different part of history in a different way. A lot was made of the fact that this was going to be the first visit by a Japanese prime minister. We found out that that's not exactly true, that in 1951, Prime Minister Yoshida was there, but very quietly. So there wasn't a lot made of it, which would have been probably inappropriate at that point in time. So do we look at Prime Minister Abe as moving to not just the post-war years, but also looking at a future in which the United States plays a different role?
Well, I think it's more of a future in which Japan plays a different role, but it's more that it's a country that is, in a lot of ways, looks at the past, interprets, and makes use of the past in a different way. And it is, again, to move beyond this notion of Japan as a repentant power, and one that says that after 70 years, it's time to begin anew. And so while, yes, he is a conservative nationalist, which gives him the credentials to, if you will, move forward in ways that others do not, and to make a gesture such as this visit that other perhaps more progressive or left-leaning politicians would not have the credibility, perhaps, in some parts of Japan. This allows him, I think, to say we are... He's proven to be a very pragmatic politician, in fact. And some of us that were very skeptical, I think, have had to dial back some of that skepticism and acknowledge, quite frankly, the skills that he's demonstrated in the little more than, you know, 3 years or almost 4 years now since he took office for the second term.
So how does that square generally with his foreign policy?
Well, it fits quite nicely. I mean, he is someone who is absolutely... unhesitant to assert Japan's presence in the world as he calls it, a first-tier country, and that requires Japan to be more assertive. If you look at his national security agenda since he's taken office, he's pushed a great deal of legislation, the reinterpretation of collective self-defense in ways that allow Japan to assume, a higher profile role. And so it fits in quite nicely. And this gesture, like the speech to Canberra, like the speech to Congress a year ago, like the Comfort Women Agreement with South Korea, is all part of trying to demonstrate a desire to recognize, understand, and then move on from history, not to forget it, but I think to acknowledge that it's past and then to try to put it in the context that allows him to move Japan forward and advance his slightly more nationalist foreign policy and national security agenda.
You mentioned a while back that he is also seeking to create the place for Japan in the world that looks a little different than it did perhaps in past. How does that square with the settlement with Russia, or at least an attempt to get one?
Well, that's also part of this. As a nationalist, Japan would like to reclaim the territory that it believes that the Russians seized or the Soviets seized at the end of World War II. And in particular, Abe has a personal connection to this. It was a key agenda of his father's. So I think that is a larger piece of this agenda of reshaping the parameters, if you will, and the framework within Japan operates as foreign policy, and to reshape the relationship with Russia becomes integral insofar as well as I think there are people in the Japanese foreign policy establishment and close to the prime minister himself who see this as a way of, if you will, putting some distance between Moscow and Beijing and to avoid driving those two potential Japanese antagonists into their arms. And so this creates a little breathing space, I think, for Tokyo as well.
And what about for the United States under President Trump?
Well, that's a really fascinating question, and I'm not sure where President Trump would... how he will interpret much of this. I'm reasonably certain he's not up to speed on the intricacies of Japanese foreign policy at this point. But to the degree that you see a Trump administration being less hardline against and less oppositional to Russia, then that certainly creates more space for Abe to pursue his own foreign policy, because the chief concern right now is the degree to which any overtures that Abe makes potentially is seen as driving a wedge or dividing the G7 and the West in its opposition to Russian behavior.
And just to bring this back to next week and the visit by Prime Minister Abe to Pearl Harbor, is this also just a final farewell to President Obama?
Plainly, yes. I mean, the clock tells us that. But again, I think it is part of a larger agenda that we've been talking about. And so, I can't see President Trump quite being in the same stream of history, if you will, and quite investing in this. It doesn't seem to me to really resonate the same way that it does with Obama, because this kind of historical reconciliation really, really fits within the entire pattern of the Obama administration. And quite frankly, it's the relationship between Abe and Obama, which has at times been tense, but I think very much moved the relationship, the bilateral relationship, forward on very, very many important levels.
And that's what we will wait and see, mm-hmm. whether it happens with President Trump. Thank you so much for the time.
No problem. Thank you.
Brad Glosserman is executive director of the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu, an independent program of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Hi, good morning. I'm Tony Gill from Honolulu. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Question: how is the original Hawaii 5-0 series connected to the Bishop Museum, Eye of Pacific Guide Dogs Foundation, the Hawaii Association for Retarded Citizens, Lions Eye Bank and Makana Foundation, our Hawaiian Humane Society, Honolulu Museum of Art, Hospice Hawaii, PBS Hawaii, the Salvation Army, and quite a few more? All these organizations receive support through the Hawaii Community Foundation from the Jack and Marie Lord Fund, which they started with a gift of $50,000. Upon their passing, all their assets, including the real estate holdings in Hawaii, were given to the Lord Fund in 2006. It was worth $40 million. At that time, it was one of the single largest gifts in the country. So next time you're stuck in traffic because they're shooting another 5-0 episode, just remember, the show's legacy will change lives in Hawaii for a very long time to come. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Mark Tyrone. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we examine the first visit to Pearl Harbor by a Japanese prime minister. As we just heard from Brad Glosserman, that was done by Shigeru Yoshida in 1951. During a layover in Hawaii, the prime minister paid a brief visit to Pearl Harbor. He was accompanied by the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, Admiral Arthur Radford. The two men posed for a photo that would have been an unimaginable sight only a few years earlier. Understandably, both governments were concerned over public perception of the visit at that point, and no official record was published explaining the present-day confusion on this. This all took place after Prime Minister Yoshida's trip to San Francisco, where he signed the Treaty of San Francisco, also known as the Treaty of Peace with Japan, a document which officially outlined Japan's relationship with the United States and its neighbors, and is still in effect today.
And Bill Edward Arca of Ever Beach, or originally from Ever Beach, who now lives in San Diego, knew the answer to that. Kudos to him. That's pretty good, huh? And at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our tastes in movies tell us a great deal about ourselves, for good or ill. And at year's end, it's fun to look back on the films we heard a lot about, some of the ones we didn't, and what our choices reveal about the way we look at the world. Barry Rivers, who puts together each year's Maui Film Festival's First Light screenings, has had plenty of opportunities to reflect on this year's crop, and he's with us by phone. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Great.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things I like about the end of the year is you get really good movies, don't you?
You do. You know, I mean, they released them in a different pattern than they did years ago when American Beauty won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. I'd say at least 10 years or so ago, it sort of proved that a film could release as early as April. I think subsequently Hurt Locker released in February, and it managed to win the Best Picture as well. So
yeah,
they do release them throughout the year somewhat more than they used to. But, yeah, the end of the year, the final last quarter, November, December, is where that's a sweet spot for sure.
Idea is to kind of stack up your marquee movies for the Academy screeners to vote, you know.
That's right.
Have a recent memory of the movie for,
that's exactly right,
for the Academy
Awards. To the
Awards.
Extent any of us have a memory anymore at all.
Exactly. Well, yeah, we're sort of dealing with short attention spans, which kind of got me thinking about what's happened to movies. There are so many, you know, the comic books have taken over the movies. There must be 40 or 50.
Not the ones that I watch.
Well, that's what
but
I'm
yes,
saying.
You're right.
Yeah, but one of the things I like about your selections, Barry, is that it's refreshingly free of, you know, movies that were once comic books and aren't much more than comic books in their current form.
That's in large part because while they do promote those films for special, for, you know, for the craft categories, you know, lighting and special effects and that sort of thing, they tend not to make quite as big a push as they do for a film which they really think has best picture possibilities or best actor, actress possibilities, those kind of things, best director and so forth. So, yeah, it, you know, the event is what it is. People always tell me, God, what a great schedule you have. It's like, well, write a letter to a studio or two, or this year, actually, write a letter to a couple of independent distributors and thank them, because this is an especially independent year in terms of what's really rising to the top.
Yes.
And, you know, all I can do is just pick the best stuff that, that I'm offered. And thankfully, you know, I have great relationships with all the studios and a lot of mini major divisions of those studios and independent distributors. And that's really why the program is, I think, probably as strong as it's ever been this year. I'm not sure it's stronger, but we really have a rockin' sockin' program this year.
Independents have a lot more clout in the industry than they used to be, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, this year, as far as the Golden Globes go, the top most nominated film was La La Land, the next most nominated film was Moonlight, and the third most nominated film was Manchester by the Sea. We have them all in the program mm-hmm. this year. In fact, we've done screenings of them twice. The second screenings are mostly upcoming as special encores. But, yeah, I just sort of had a sense that it was going to be a year for those kind of films, and thankfully the studios I deal with and independent distributors were willing to oblige and allow me a couple of screenings of those things. So, yeah, we have a great program. I'm really thrilled with it.
What's
and, you know, great stuff. Yet we've had, just so you know, or your listeners know, we've had 1, 2, 3, 4. I think 4 days of First Light so far. We have 4 more to go. And quite a few of the films that we're showing in these next 4 days are films that are really only being released in New York and L.A., and Maui, kind of. You know, I think Aspen might have some of them as well. So it's a really special opportunity for people who are visiting the island from the industry to see these films, you know, in the beautiful Castle Theater at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, but also for people on Maui to be able to attend and enjoy them as well.
Well, Barry, one of the things about the movies that have made it through to the top of critical attention this year is that a lot of them have, in making the movie, have an element of risk where you can see the, you know, the executives saying, oh, you know, nobody's going to want to see a movie about an interracial couple,
right,
as in Loving.
Right.
Our musicals are dead, as
right,
in La La Land. Our, you know, nobody's going to want to see a play about Black America, as in Fences. Right. Everything you can see, all of those movies would have been objected to by the sort of the standard Hollywood filter that movies seem
right
to go through.
Right. That's why so many of them have come out from the independent distributors this year. You know, they saw them at Sundance and fell in love with them or thought there was a niche for them and decided to sort of take on the hard work and the risk of turning all their efforts into something worthwhile, which is not just award acclaim, but also, you know, they need to make enough money to be able to buy a bunch more films next year. So, yeah, we feel really lucky to have this group of films.
The whole special effects comic book trend, I've wondered the last couple of ones that I've seen, have wondered if we aren't moving toward a kind of an overkill in the sense of how much more special can a special effect get?
Well, let us pray that you're right about that. Yeah, it's all such a crapshoot. I mean, you know, it's sort of the old expression, you know, people don't know what they don't know. So they don't know that a film's going to be a hit until it gets out there and actually becomes one. And it's the rare thing. You know, they're sort of a diamond when they happen that way. Otherwise, they're just sort of a bunch of, you know, carbon clumped together that doesn't quite lift off. But, you know, they've made some really wise choices this year. They've made some important films, I think, this year. They're dealing with, I mean, Moonlight's an important film, especially given all the challenges that, you know, people have had in this country who are people of color, mm-hmm. Let alone the rest of us who go along for the ride of a sort of a less harmonious culture than we might otherwise have. So, yeah, there's some tough stuff out there. There's also some beautiful stuff out there, and First Light every year is a mix of both. You know, we've made a commitment when we started doing our first films on Wednesdays in 1997 to present compassionate vision and life-affirming storytelling, and we've done that and take great pride in that, in part because I just think what people see determines to a large degree who they become and who, in turn, the culture writ large becomes. But for First Light, I don't like to be an ostrich either, so we take the sort of those compassionate vision blinders off just a little bit. And if you're truly compassionate, I guess there's compassion for all things. But that said, you know, there's some tough subject material being shown at First Light because I don't want to live in a world where I'm not aware of what's going on. You know, I mean, I choose to look in, you know, sort of in a brighter, lighter direction. But I know there's a lot of, you know, pain and suffering in the world, and I think it's important to shine a light on those things as well to try and alleviate the pain and suffering in those cases where it exists.
When you make a movie about a difficult subject, you have to have a lot of respect for your audience, right?
That's right. Yeah, you do.
They're going to sit through this. They're not just going to say it's depressing. They're going to see that there's a kind of something to be gained from a sad story. Yeah.
You know, I actually saw a film the other day, which is not in First Light, just to be fair to the world of film and, you know, overall. We saw a film called Collateral Beauty. It's not been very well reviewed, but it was a touching, deeply moving film,
mm-hmm.
and one that was atypical for a big studio to take on, at least in the last number of years when they've sort of focused on other kinds of things. But it just reminded me, I mean, just how much a great film can affect you, even if it brings you to tears rather than, you know, just laughing at some silliness on the screen. So I think it's important, and it's why I continue to do this. And you know, this has always been cinema activism for me. You know, I've always had an interest in trying to put my thumb on the scale of which way I'd like to see the world going, and this is one small way that I get a chance to do that every year.
One of the things that makes watching the whole movie scene fun is that it's unpredictable. You know that William Goldman's comment in his book,
right,
that nobody knows anything.
Right.
Right. At the end of the day in Hollywood, nobody knows anything, and there's every year has a surprise, a success that no one could have predicted.
I mean, most recently, you know, there's been a lot of acclaim for the three films I mentioned, you know, Moonlight and La La Land and Manchester by the Sea. But we had a film that actually opened the festival this past June at the Celestial Cinema, which is our Under the Stars venue, called Captain Fantastic, which is about a fella whose wife is ill. She's in the hospital, and they have been raising their kids in the woods of the Northwest.
Yeah.
You know, and so living a Mother Earth lifestyle, for lack of a better way to describe it. And it was a wonderful film, and it really wasn't getting a whole lot of buzz until people finally actually started looking at these screeners. You know, you mentioned screeners earlier. For people that don't know, these are DVDs that people who are in the industry get sent by the studios because they want to expose them to these films they think are award-worthy. And sure enough, it's, Viggo Mortensen, who stars in the film, has had a couple of nominations, including one from the Screen Actors Guild. I believe they got an ensemble. Yeah, in fact, I'm looking at it right now. Outstanding performance by a cast in a motion picture. Captain Fantastic's at the top of the list, and the other films on that list are Fences, Hidden Figures, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. We've got them all. But it's nice to see a film that was released earlier in the year and was wonderful not get lost in the shuffle and the sort of craziness of the end of the year.
Kind of makes you believe in popular taste, doesn't it, Barry? Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris.
Me too. Barry Rivers is the coordinator of the Maui Film Festival's First Light screenings, which run until December 28th at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Bill, your first conversation talked with the difficult issue of mental illness and mental, you know, depression that sets in at the holidays, because there is all this kind of pressure to be
right.
to be joyous,
yes.
right? And,
yeah.
and you know, it was a reminder that there are people who just for one reason or another just can't.
Yeah, you know, year-end brings reflection for a lot of people, and
yeah.
sometimes there can be pain associated with that as well, but good to hear that also that is not, abnormal is maybe a bad way of putting it, but it's common, it's shared. That
yeah.
also is part of what we share.
And we're coming to understand it far better than we used to, which is a very welcome trend, yeah?
That is true. We'd like to hear from you, by the way. You can call our talkback line, leave us your comments, 808-792-8217. Email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments, Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or you can reach Beth Ann at BKOZHPR.
And tomorrow we're going to look ahead to the next week's celebration of Kwanzaa. And if you missed any of this show or want to hear a past show, we archive our shows on our website at undertheconversation@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Bill Dorman in for Beth Ann Kosovich this morning. Hope she's feeling better, but you can join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.